Hello and welcome back to Carbon Copies Podcast. This episode will cover the basic process of how we could get from a brain reservation to a reconstruction as a whole brain emulation. These explanations of the computational neuroscience behind the technology are presented by Dr. Ren Okuno, who's the founder of the Carbon Copies Foundation. And if after listening to this podcast you want to find out more about the topic, you can find us online at carboncopies.org. But now let's get started.
We intend to discuss explicitly the assumptions and the putative process for taking a preserved brain all the way to a whole brain emulation with restored cognitive functions and therefore the uploaded mind equal to that to the one that was used that used to exist in the original brain. You're probably aware that while the technical solution that leads to mind uploading is known as whole brain emulation, there are more than one way to achieve that. The two main directions that are being explored are either whole brain emulation via repeated neural prosthesis, which is considered an in vivo process, and whole brain emulation from preserved brain tissue, which is considered a post-mortem process. So here's the putative process for repeated neural prosthesis. The type of information we need for that is largely activity data, so data that's recorded in the living brain, with only some structure data required, such as, for example, having some notion of what the layout is of a given part of the brain that you're trying to build a neural prosthesis for. That's because in this approach, you use system identification to identify the functions happening in a particular part of the brain. Now, what you need are some constraints so that you can initialize a feasibly derivable and constrained model using the generic knowledge that we have of the circuit connectome and suitable kernel functions for those. Then you want to be able to collect data from the area you're trying to identify that you're trying to build a neural prosthesis for. This is where the most of the data that you need for this process comes from, functional recording inside the neural circuit. And you have to record from some percentage of the neurons. I put X percent here because we don't know exactly how many you need. It probably depends on the neural coding in that particular area. And then the next step, important step, is identification. That's when you use a machine learning approach to search the model parameter space and fit the kernel functions based on the data that you've collected, this recording data that's there. Then you carry out validation, meaning you're taking the model that you're building and you try to identify how well this model actually fits, first of all, the data that you used to develop it, but then also a second set of data that was not used to build the model, to see if this model is now predicting, if it is giving you a good match of what should be the output for this previously unseen input. Then you need an implementation, like a device that can run the model and the functions that you just derived. And then when you've done that, then you can use these neuroprosthetic replacements. If you make those for all the different parts of the brain, ultimately you have a whole brain emulation. And then when you have a whole brain emulation, now we're at the upload panel there. That's where you can use this artificial substrate that the mind is in as a place where the mind is backed up and operating. And then, of course, because you have complete access to everything that's going on there, you can see how it works. You can use the backup to make sure that you have an undo function when you try out new things, and you can improve and enhance the mind. So this is for the repeated neural prosthesis approach. Now, the other one from preserved brain tissue has a lot of similar panels, similar steps involved. But some of them are done a little differently. First of all, we see here that the type of information needed, here the information leans more heavily towards using a lot of structure data, a lot of information about this piece of tissue that you've got, and only a little bit of activity data, different kinds of activity data. So you rely a lot on things we know about generic brains and how the activity is supposed to appear in a human brain in a particular region of the brain in a certain neural circuit. And you might just use a little bit of actual activity recording that came from that sample. Then for the constraints, we use a somewhat different approach because now we're mostly coming from structural information. So you'll use something like the cable modem model that is an example of how you can derive how a neuron or its pieces, its dendrites should work based on things you see in an image that comes from the structural sort of the sampling, the sliced brain sample that you've got. And you can use that together with knowledge about the circuits that are supposed to exist in a given area, with the types of neurons that are there, the types of synapses you expect, and information about things like neurotransmitter vesicles that you can count to see how strong a synapse probably is at this moment, to make estimates of what the parameters are for this model that you're trying to build. So these these things like the counts that you've got, the measurements you can take, what you know about what the system's supposed to be. These are all constraints on the model that you build when you get around to building it. But first, before we build it, there's, again, there's a collection of validation data. You're going to have to do some kind of validation. So you need something to test your models with.
In the end, of course, you'd want both of those different approaches to lead to the same thing. That in that case, they would both be doing things right. This workshop is all about trying to make clear and concrete the challenges in this second procedure. So the one from preserved brain tissue, the one that's necessary if you begin with a preserved brain that may have been in storage for many years. Every one of the process panels here leads to a number of serious questions. Before we even consider practical constraints, we need to critically assess our theoretical assumptions about the types of information that would be needed to be able to reconstruct and revive a mind. Information specific to that neural tissue. So details of the connectome ultrastructure, details such as the locations and identities of ion channels and the quantity and distribution of neurotransmitter vesicles, and other molecular details. So a fingerprint or test set of that brain's healthy operation. But a big question is, of course, what else makes up the traces of memory engrams, if there is something else? Then there's generic information generic to the human brain, a detailed understanding of the interactions between healthy brain systems, a detailed understanding of expected dynamic activity in a healthy brain at multiple resolutions and scales. We want an understanding of expected dynamic activity in functionally specialized brain regions. But what else is theoretically needed to complement preserved brain data to be able to use that for a dynamic model? And here I wanted to do a quick aside about memory. For further clarity and care in the use of our terminology, I'd like to do that. Memory is the way in which prior states or events, details of the past, affect events in the present and future. In math and physics, we could say that a process has memory if its response function contains hysteresis. There are a lot of points at which brain biology contains dynamic processes with hysteresis. Some are described as up or down regulation, some as apoptosis or genesis of, say, neurons or synapses, some as potentiation or depotentiation of synapses, for example. Each of them has its own characteristic time course. It's undoubtedly true that all of these interacting processes with hysteresis in our brains together express who we are as a result of both our prenatal development and our experiences. At any given moment, the states of all these response functions together determine how our neural circuits work and how our mind processes information. When we say that we want to produce a working emulation of a brain to revive the mind, we mean that we want a relatively close approximation of all these interacting response functions, perhaps with some abstraction to less compute-intensive envelope functions. In a worst-case scenario, this means that we may need to be able to identify traces of most or all the physiological mediators for these functions. On top of that, we want our reconstruction to be able to change its response to experience in much the same way as the brain does. In a worst-case scenario, this means that we may need to be able to identify or infer most or all of the parameters governing the hysteresis in each response function. Simplistically, let's say that the effect of neuron A on neuron B could be expressed as this equation here, where the voltage in B is some change of the initial voltage there, the original membrane potential, plus some function of a whole bunch of contributors. You know, this is the, so there's a dynamic function there, and every one of those parameters is some sort of mediator that influences B based on the activity of A. Some of those parameters may even belong to really obtuse mediators, such as some long-term up or down regulation caused by changes in neighboring glia due to field effects from A or whatever. So questions there are, how do we obtain all these dynamic tuning parameters from the preserved brain? I'm not saying that they're not there, but how do we get them? Are there visible traces from which to infer each one? Or how else do we go about that? Now that was the easy stuff. Now we have to get honest and set aside the purely theoretical questions and confront some practical considerations. Let's assess our ideas about how a working model can be built from a preserved data. We'll want to reconstruct the 3D architecture of the neural tissue so that at a minimum, we need to find neurons, neurites, and probable locations of synapses. What else? We'll want to identify brain regions for which we have generic knowledge that can help us constrain the modeling process. What else do we need to do there? And we'll want to identify classes of neural system components, such as neuron types, synapse types, neurotransmitter channel types, and what else? Then, we'll need a library of functional models or model types from which to select a set of candidate models that may be suitable for each identified component, and we'll need an algorithmic process for making those selections. And what else there? For each component, we'll want to winnow down the possible model functions and look for intelligent approximations. So how do we use the available information to winnow down the number of choices to one? For each model component, we're going to need to collect structural metrics that further constrain possible functional characteristics, such as neurite lengths and diameters that are applied in a cable model of a neurite, or such as synaptic spine surface shapes to use those as an estimate for the strength, something like the cell body shape and size and the number and density of neurotransmitter vesicles, and what else? There's probably more. We'll need to determine the methods by which obtainable information can be used to constrain and estimate those parameter values associated with each model function. So how can we ensure an optimal solution for each parameter or for each set of parameters? Now, as we're combining innumerable estimated component functions, we're going to need to counteract compounding errors, you know, as we put all these different estimates together. To do that, we need to infer to some degree of abstraction the intended neural circuit function above the granular reconstruction level. For example, such circuit level intentions can include permissible circuit dynamics, activity ranges, and homeostatic processes. Do we need recorded activity from each moderately sized circuit? Is there some other way to reliably constrain the constructed circuit function? For example, can we confidently apply rules of thumb to identify circuit categories in typical brain architecture, such as in cortical mini columns, for instance? Can we record additional data in advance to improve the odds for positive answers to these questions? So is there a sweet spot, for instance, where recording neural activity at some minimum resolution and time interval when stored together with the preserved brain solves these problems? We need to take into account our criteria for success in a reconstruction procedure. How do we measure the degree of success? If we're talking about a procedure that may take place many years in the future, then these metrics need to work even when there's no one around who knew the patient whose brain was preserved. So validation data is going to be needed at multiple levels. At the highest level, we might compare with behavioral recordings and completed assessment questionnaires or something like that. But what do those have to include? Then at a systems level, a healthy human brain will be expected to exhibit certain characteristic dynamic activity. We have to ask ourselves what constitutes a generic fingerprint of a healthy brain or healthy brain dynamics. Then at the individual level, characteristic mental activity must arise from individually unique brain activity, right? That's kind of our assumption of what makes us all slightly different. This level of accuracy is more demanding than a generic fingerprint. What's the minimum satisfactory fingerprint of brain activity to confirm a specific human being? As we increase the resolution of our available validation data to, say, data within brain regions or data within neural circuits, so we increase our ability to confirm that the modeled complex system activity will evolve in a manner that is confidently within the range of plausible evolutions that might have been taken by the activity in the original system. So as the original system would change, how would it evolve its response? And is what we're seeing in this model that we're creating, is that showing a similar kind of evolution? Is it within plausible paths of evolution? How could we collect validation data at the resolutions and scales needed for this? So a lot of data that we've discussed so far might be satisfied by data that can be obtained from the brain tissue itself. We have to consider carefully the effects of both the initial process of brain preservation and of the long-term storage method, because that may have an effect on that data in one way or another. Given the questions asked so far, what may they imply and what may be obtained from the brain tissue? What is usefully preserved by current methods? And what would we need to know, like what kind of new methods would we need in order to preserve the rest of that data usefully? So, and with additional peer review and evaluation, hopefully, we can qualify how aldehyde stabilized cryopreservation stacks up for all these needs. Of course, in addition to the type, we also need to know what proportion of the necessary information is preserved usefully. So what's the scale and coverage that's presently achievable? How about density and what sort of artifacts occur and how frequently? For instance, is every neuron, every synapse, and every neurotransmitter vesicle preserved? How does missing data affect the restoration process? Are there corrective measures and do they require information of another type from secondary sources? Such as, for example, regional dynamics that can be used to estimate the influence on the system of this unrecoverable data. Of the type and proportion of information that's preserved, how reliable is it? What is the impact of noise and confounding variables on the process of restoration? Are there corrective measures, and do they require information of another type from secondary sources? In processing the preserved tissue, consider data collection, analysis, and synthesis. What are the practical solutions to do that in both an acceptable time frame with acceptable reliability and introducing a minimum of errors? Is all of the information that we preserved also visible to the scan? What sort of mistakes would be expected? To carry out model selection and parameter estimation in the model building stage, do we know how to interpret the data to identify necessary constraints? Okay, so we've now reached the model building stage after all those questions. At this point, we have to consider the practical challenges of model selection and parameter estimation in very large systems with many parameters and uncertainty in the data. Fundamental challenges to model selection, parameter fitting, and machine learning methods that are applied to these are that they break down by either never finding stable solutions, by being too resource intensive, or by taking too long to converge on a solution. And when we talk about these problems, we're not talking about a factor of 10 or 1,000 that could be overcome by compute advances. Machine learning problems that are theoretically tractable still easily explode to ones that are in practice completely impossible, demanding more time and material than the world can possibly provide. Modeling much smaller subsystems can be a solution. But if we're talking about smaller subsystems, so how is the decomposition carried out to ensure likely modeling success for such subsystems? Within each subsystem, there's a process of model initialization and parameter search, often carried out a number of times. How do we use available constraining information to carry out model selection for each component? Which are the best parameter search algorithms in each case and with the available constraining information? How do we ensure correct interaction between separately modeled subsystems? Reconstruction at the granular level leaves a lot of room for compounding errors that can break higher level circuit function that depends on interacting components. A series of concatenated mistakes at the granular level may be very hard to track down without independent information that tells us something about the higher level circuit functions that is expected to result. Reconstruction could get bogged down in an impossible debugging task, in other words. So how do you avoid that labyrinth of compounding errors? It's likely that the brain's neural coding already includes many safeguards to counteract these problems, and we can take inspiration from those. So with this, we come to the essential task of validating and correcting models of the reconstructed brain. And that's actually what my talk later on, since this is just the introduction, is about model validation. In practice, no model of any realistic complexity is correct when first built. Even in theory, it's unlikely that one correct model estimation is possible because many estimation procedures for dynamic systems and their parameters will produce more than one possible result. As mentioned earlier, we'll want to validate with dynamic fingerprints at behavioral system, individual, and further predictive levels. We must also realize that validation is statistical. Correct performance will fall within a range of statistically plausible responses. For instance, if we were validating the activity of a single neuron, then we would be validating its spike probability function rather than a specific sequence of spike times. So this means that we need to devise relevant validation metrics with that in mind. At the highest resolution, we'd be concerned about a firing probability function rather than specific spike sequences, right? So how is this validation performed? And again, I'm not giving the answers here, I'm just stating the questions. Model correction. Validation has to tell us more than just that a model is imperfect. We already knew that going in. Every model is imperfect and needs improvement. We need to learn a lot about how the model is failing and where to look for the most promising improvements. So model selection and parameter search space is really big, and we need to optimize the corrective information that we get. So beyond validation data that's merely a success metric, what type of validation data stored alongside a preserved brain would enable practical model correction? Now, it should be obvious at this point that successful modeling involves iterations of model selection and parameter search, then model validation and corrective changes for the next iteration. To be practically successful, the modeling method must also reach an acceptable result in a limited number of iterations and within an acceptable time interval. What do we need to know to devise such a method? And I'll be saying a bit more about that, especially about validation data and validation processes, in my talk later in the workshop. Okay, now we've reached the whole brain emulation panel. To revive a mind, a successful model needs to be run in an artificial brain, a processing platform that can emulate whole brain function at a speed that enables responsive behavior at a desired rate of sensation and response. Given the types of models that are considered in the preceding questions, there will be a list of mathematical functions that are used in combination and distribution of frequencies and rates and at which these functions are expected to be used. So can we anticipate what these functions will be and what rates they'll be used at? Are there helpful and warranted model simplifications? For whole brain emulation performance that's at par or better than a normal human brain, in terms of both reliability, speed, resource consumption, we should probably seek a good match between the hardware design and the prevailing processing functions. Can we anticipate well-aligned or adaptable hardware development directions? We probably can, but I'm not going to get into the answers here, just putting the questions up. The purpose of an emulated brain is to upload, transfer, and back up mental functions accurately, but also to enable careful modification for improvement. What does a full backup of data in a brain emulation involve? What do we know about the ubiquity and rate of change in the brain? How about compressed representations of those changes? The conversation around mind uploading goes beyond these topics, of course, and way beyond the topics of this workshop. We could ask, for example, what upgrade paths are possible given the circuit function and knowledge representations in the human brain? What are the existing gaps between human brain function and all possible intelligent functions? How can we improve learning and the integration of knowledge? How can we improve reliability and performance? How can we overcome more fundamental hurdles, such as thinking in more dimensions, such as concurrently enabling tabula rasa learning versus learning in systems with prior knowledge patterns, such as reasoning that explores multiple possible solutions concurrently? Finally, how do all of the challenges we considered impact what we really should aim to preserve about a brain's activity and its structure to make restoration realistically and practically possible, or even likely? Given what's at stake, it would be inadequate and dishonest to make hand-waving claims about brain data preservation that could realistically be used to restore the proverbial Jane Doe from her preserved data. What's really necessary is to study the process of restoration from which the data requirements are derived. Sure, at this stage, we can't provide a complete working restoration process, but we're making enough inroads to start making educated judgments. And examples of these inroads are the work done by the OpenWorm project, work done on restoration from Drosophila connectome, and of course, progress in human neural prosthesis. The best we can hope for in this foray is to highlight the existence of all these crucial questions as a way to put the present situation with brain preservation into the proper perspective within the context of mind uploading.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the podcast. If you want to find out more about whole brain emulation, you can find us online at carbonpuppies.org.